right. May I introduce you the speaker, Dustin Hoffmann. Dustin is in the European Parliament since 2014, is an office manager. He studied law and has been very close with the current crises. Ukraine and other crises have spawned debates on international law in different channels. And, well, Dustin Hoffmann, come up, please. I am sure that he, with his years of experience in politics, can debunk a few myths and give us some insights. And thus, a big applause for Dustin Hoffmann. Thanks a lot for the lovely moderation. I'm very happy to be here again. I'm also very happy that I can see you in real life after all those years of absence. When at the last talk my internet shut down and most of it didn't work out. So lovely. I have a lot to talk about. I looked for topics and then I thought about the self-defense law as a topic. So I usually choose a topic with which I cannot annoy my friends anymore. So this year, this topic didn't let me go. So I thought, let's give a talk for some people that have never ever dealt with this already and go out with more insights. And while creating this talk, I was getting aware that some people will be more confused than they were in the beginning. But let's just start. I'm going to talk about the right for self-defense in modern international law. I'm going to explain why modern international law has been illustrated like this with a ship from 18-something in the first slide. I'm going to tell you that. I'm going to have a quick start, talk about the historical background of the self-defense law, the legal background, the prerequisites, and then a few things that are more complicated, and then give a quick summary, and then you can decide whether you're more confused or more informed. So, Sir Humphrey Waldock was a judge, a president of the International Court of the UN. He was judge, president at the European Court in Strasbourg, and international law professor in Oxford. 1952, in a lecture in Den Haag, he said, "There are few more important questions in international law than the proper limits of the right of self-defense." And fascinatingly, that didn't change since then. The debate are still vividly alive, and in the meantime, he could not foresee debates on Twitter, but they became more emotional. And I brought a few examples that you can look at, and during the talk, I'll get back on that. Sorry, all of those quotes are in German. At 9th of October, 2 days after the terror attack at the 7th of October in Israel, Amnesty Germany has denounced the terror attacks, talked about Professor aus München hat dazu gesagt,
and someone in Munich said that there was a spelling error in legitimate right. And then the chairman of another institution said that when talking about a ceasefire, then this would delegitimize the right of self-defense in Israel. And after the attack, it was said that Israel does have a right to self-defense in accordance with international law. I'll get back to that in a second. It's especially interesting as a statement These are not legal statements, but they're more political or are motivated in another way, especially the one of Ursula von der Leyen is going to be important for us. What do we need for self-defense? Why do we need it at all? Modern international law, after the First and Second World War, when the world community came together and said that was not a good idea what happened, we would like this to not happen again. So they came together and claimed the Charter of the United Nations, and that states that all the members are in charge of keeping each other safe, and the goal is that no force should be threatened or acted out. So even the threat would be a breach of international law. We did not. We talk about force, but in the beginning, it was a ban on war itself, and then they just waged war and didn't call it war anymore. We still have states that want to get out of the responsibility and call it special military operations. That doesn't work anymore. Just because they don't call it war, it's still war, and it's prohibited. And that is international law. And if somebody had Latin in school and want to feel like this made sense, they're happy to see that there are Latin terms in international law for everybody who did this in school. The prohibition of force in international law, you could think state A is attacking state B. State B has a problem because it cannot use force, and of course that is included. There are exceptions. There are several exceptions. The first is not so very relevant, is Chapter 7, Measures of the UN Security Council. It's an organ that is responsible by made up of 15 states, permanent and non-permanent. But the downside is that five members have a veto: France, US, Great Britain, Russia, and China. And as you might have noticed, in recent past there were some conflicts where they said, oh, maybe the UN Security Council should say stop this, but there were parties involved that had a veto right, and that's why it's quite dysfunctional. So Chapter 7, those are the competencies of the Security Council. It can say, oh yeah, ceasefire, we're going to take some peace troops there. So in the international law, sovereignty of any nation is set. No one can enter this state except for the UN Security Council. They can take this over temporarily and send peace troops. The second most relevant exception is the right to self-defense, which we're talking about today. And the third is consensuality. If a state says, I can't really cope right now, Russia, please exert force in our territory, that would also be legal. Let's look back in history. That was the cover I showed. That's happening in 18-something, the U.S. ship Caroline burning at Niagara Falls, and this is the one historical incident that is the basis for the right of self-defense. There were incitements in Canada, and the Brits were accusing the U.S. Americans of supporting those insurrections. They took over the ship, killed people, burned it down, and let it drift over the Niagara Falls. And after that, there was a letter exchange between politicians of both nations in a very diplomatic way about what they consider the right to self-defense in international law. And that led to them agreeing with each other what the criteria of self-defense might be. The US said, this was not a case, but we accept the criteria. And those criteria, we call them Caroline criteria,
Austria because of that. They are still the same today. There needs to be an imminent necessity that is very big, that does not allow you any time to think otherwise, and the choice of means needs to be adequate. So necessity and adequacy, I'm going to get into that a bit more. Still relevant from the 1800s, even though the actual incident wasn't that important, but it made it through time. One of the most important things that you need to keep in mind, let's think about the tweet from Ursula von der Leyen, is the differentiation between jus ad bellum and jus in bellum. Jus ad bellum, what we're talking about, it's towards war, the option to whereas jus in bello is the humanitarian law that it applies during war. People came together and said, we don't want war, but we know it's going to happen, so at least we should have some rules that the damage is mitigated for everybody involved. Jus in bello has rules for the use of force, whereas jus ad bellum is in charge of the greater whole. Just to give you a very strong example, if Russia attacks Ukraine, and Ukraine, in the course of self-defense, breaches the international law, it doesn't lose the right to self-defense. On the other hand, if somebody has a perfect war by the state charter of the international law, can still overreach his right to self-defense. So Ursula von der Leyen says that Israel has a right to self-defense in accordance with international law. That's quite imprecise, because the right to self-defense still applies even though if Israel breaches international law in a humanitarian sense. So legally, maybe not. The right to self-defense also made it to Article 51 of the UN Charter. The background is it wasn't supposed to be in there, it's habitual law, but Latin American countries were afraid and thus they wanted to have it codified in writing. That's probably not bad, and it says this charter does not limit the natural right to individual or collective self-defense, that the necessary measures need to be taken to ensure international security. That's quite a weird way to put it. Then they thought it's like this: state A attacks the state B, defends itself, needs emergency help, calls the Security Council, says, I'm doing self-defense, come on, please help us. As I said, the Security Council is a bit dysfunctional, that's why that doesn't really work. And that's why nations nowadays use the right to self-defense and send a letter to the Security Council sometimes, but not always. Even if you don't do it, you don't lose that right, but it's important to make a statement where it comes from, so it has a realistic background in the thinking. The important piece here is the attack with weapons. That's a necessary condition for self-defense. So if you don't have an attack with weapons, then there is no self-defense. So, an armed attack implies the use of arms, and if one state exerts pressure onto another nation via sanctions or other economic means, that does not count. After an armed attack, there are some difficulties. Not each use of force is an armed attack.
There's a threshold. Most people accept that. There's a threshold where small border infractions do not automatically call for the right to self-defense. where small clashes are, because there's instances where small clashes were used as justification for violence. But an important side note, what in case of attacks from non-state actors? Because when people thought up the international law, states really put thoughts into this. Today, there are a lot of terrorists and militias that carry out attacks, and the international law is still looking for answers. If terrorists can be clearly assigned to one state, if they're state controlled, for example, by the Iranian Revolutionary Forces, that is basically the state of Iran, because they control the their forces. It's more difficult in case like Hamas or Al-Qaeda. And there's the dilemma that on the one hand in science and from the position of the international court, that states do not want to accept terrorist attacks on their territory and terrorists hiding there. Especially the United States thought up the unwilling or unable doctrine. Well, I brought a citation from a right counselor for state X that has suffered a terrorist attack. It is legitimate to use violence against that group if state Y does not want to suppress this group. And this, of course, it's the task of a state to look after their citizens, but this breaches the ban against violence. So I think you should also look at the other side. How do people think about this that are affected, or states that are affected? I brought a quote from Anita Twail, who says, no, because that creates a hierarchy that we actually have overcome. Normally, it's the states of the global north that use violence against states of the global south on their territory. And this is against the doctrine that all states are equal. And at the same time, it's hard for states to accept that terrorist attacks happen on their territory and they can't do anything against it. We will talk about terrorists later and today how what we can do against them. The international court, this is an important decision on military use of force, has clarified that there is a right to self-defense in the international law, and it has also made it clear that there's the principle of necessity. Necessity means that violence or force can only be used if it's necessary to prevent an attack that is imminent. So there can be no practical alternative to violence. This means that, well, there's shootings at the border, this sort of violence wouldn't be necessary. This isn't the main problem. The main problem is imminent, this term of imminence. There was a different position from the USA. Of course, the USA are very important in this whole play. And this is why they always find ideas to do things otherwise. So how about creative self-defense, such as weapons of mass destruction? So now you have to wait until, do you have to wait until they're used, or can you take preventative actions? For example, if a state starts building atomic weapons, can you attack their nuclear facilities? So actually it has to be imminent. So it's always a singular decision. For example, when was the attack on Pearl Harbor? When the first bomb dropped? When the plane started? Or a few weeks ahead? When was the point where you could have intervened? Most scientists and states do not want this principle because it softens the ban on violence too much. So, relation, the second element, not relevant is the extent of the of force used in the original attack. So when State A attacks State B with 300 soldiers, State B cannot attack back with more than 300 soldiers. So 300 soldiers can well, you would actually need more soldiers. So you can use more force to retaliate than what was originally used.
So
it's the measure of force that is necessary to take back what was originally taken. That is the test.
And
states are often doing that, and we can discuss about that. For example, in the case of Ukraine, they want Russia to stop attacking and they want to regain their territory.
And
from the perspective of Israel, it would be a legitimate goal to get back the hostages and to destroy Hamas. So, yeah, you can call that a legitimate goal because Hamas will continue to attack and is continuing to do shootings and also is saying that we will continue. So danger exists further. But if you use the test of relation, at what point can you basically do anything? Because to destroy Hamas, if you accept that as a legitimate goal, you have to use excessive force.
And
this leads to the images we see today. So you can see like that. There's a scientific debate about this. Marko Milanovic has written a very long article about this and has shown, well, it's not true to the cause anymore. Maybe we should define relation in a more narrow sense. And he's dividing between the use of force and the damage it does. So Israel should be securing the border to Gaza and then they should look what violence is needed to reach what goals. But this is a not a very popular opinion in the political science, and it's worth taking a closer look into that, if that wouldn't be a good development. So let's apply that to real life cases. Iraq 2003. As I said earlier, there was no UN Security Council decision in 2003. US and Great Britain still went there, and because they claimed that there were mass weapons of mass destruction, or that there could be such weapons, and attacked the country and took control of it. In this case, Iraq, that was a weaponized attack, of course. Self-defense can be used collectively. There were some voices in Germany that said that this is a breach of international Iraq, international law in Iraq. But today, the federal government is saying we are supporting Ukraine. So, yeah, in international law, collective self-defense is possible. A very clear but still very interesting case to look at the criteria closer is Crimea in 2014. Let's look at the criteria.
Der bewaffnete Angriff.
The weaponized attack. Let's look at the weaponized attack first.
Kleinen grünen Männchen, Männer, wie wir sie
those
wurden
small green men appeared,
die sind da
Russian soldiers with UN badges, who walked around with weapons and took control of Ukrainian organizations. And that was relatively peaceful. Ukrainian soldiers did not defend themselves in a major way. You have to look at Ukraine's situation in 2014. It was quite politically fragile, and the decision back then was to not retaliate or defend themselves, because the consequences would have been worse. And Ukraine since then has had time to prepare for an attack. But still, even if there was no shots were fired, that was still a weaponized attack. So you don't have to accept the use of bullets against yourself.
Ist die Lage,
in 2022, things, of course, escalated, and the image is clearer now.
Argument, dass sie ihre,
and Russia used the argument of having to protect their Russian minorities that would be in danger of genocide. This is not a legitimate reason.
Selbstverteidigung ausüben darf.
For self-defense, I listed the reasons earlier, and this one was not one of them.
Es gibt auch Debatten darüber.
And there's also debates the protection of citizens. So, for example, if someone has been taken hostage, you can talk about whether this can be a legitimate case, but what Russia is doing is totally incompatible with international law. But let's look at the probably most interesting and most complex case that we are seeing at the moment, where public debate is pretty unanimous. But when you look at the academic debate, I was quite surprised that there isn't unanimity at all. The position that I found in papers, well, I wouldn't post it on Twitter, let's say it like that. Let's look into the basic criteria again and try to apply them to the conflict at hand between Israel and Gaza. Gaza, the Hamas attacked Israel on 7th October. There were more than 1,000 casualties. It was an attack with weapons. So the question is, can a weaponized attack be launched by a non-state actor? And then there's the problem that Gaza isn't under control of the Palestinian Autonomy authority. And there's people who are saying, if there is no state, there is no self-defense. And luckily, thankfully, there's also the solution, because there's many actors on the international in international law who cannot be a state. We have the de facto state. This solves this problem. There are states who aren't recognized as states, but are still carriers of rights and responsibilities. And I think it fits the example of Palestine quite well, because it closes the gap in the law. But we still have the problem that Hamas isn't the government of Palestine. So do you accept Gaza as its own de facto state, or is it a war, or is it self-defense when Hamas attacks Israel as a state, which from Israel's perspective is understandable, but is very critical in international law? And this is something Marko Miladovic said in his paper. He said, well, international law is basically the wrong platform. We do not have answers. Everything is unclear, but the international law, you can't bomb hospitals, for example, you can't shoot civilians. But here we should ask ourselves ethical questions rather than questions of international law, which is frustrating, but also it's nice to see that there's an open debate in the academic world. There's one position, for example, I was surprised that this was published. A scientist published a paper where she wrote that Gaza was basically continuously under attack from Israel, and actually it's Gaza's self-defense, and you can't use self-defense against self-defense, so the deeds of Hamas would be violations of international law, so there would be the right to self-defense. And well, basically, you have to conclude that there's no clear answer. My feeling is I would follow the doctrine that Gaza is a de facto state and Israel can do something against Hamas by protecting its citizens. But it's more a question of humanitarian international law. But it's a minefield which I'm not willing to step on.
So,
to conclude, I would like to summarize what we've just heard. The right to self-defense is the most important exception of the ban on violence in the international law. The relevant elements are that there's a weaponized attack, and if there is one, you have to have necessity and relation of the self-defense. Nearly every aspect is very heavily critical. So this is why I mentioned the US several times, that is quite creative in interpreting international law. And what you always have to keep in mind when following these debates is that there's a difference between jus ad bellum and jus in bello, and that the right to self-defense is abstract from the humanitarian international law, which is extremely important and is something that the international community, especially in the current conflicts, you have to keep that in mind.
Achtet auf das humanitäre Völkerrecht.
And keep in mind and respect the humanitarian international law, because this is a humanitarian gain that we can't throw away. And well, the law is very clear and unambiguous. Well, that's not quite true. it rarely applies in international law that there's a clear stance. Well, now this has been quicker than I thought. If you have any questions or remarks, I'm happy to hear them. So before we come to the Q&A, a big applause for Dustin Hoffmann, please. Thank you.
Well, we have four microphones in the room, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Please get in line behind the microphones. This is a Q&A. You do the questions. Dustin does the answers. So please, no spontaneous lectures, just questions. Are there questions from the internet? Yeah, there's two questions. We'll start with the first one. All right. A question from Nachtvogel, who is asking for other examples of de facto states.
So, there's one topic that I had intense research about. Those non-Südossetien, they're very small countries that haven't been seen as real countries, but are those.
Mic 2, please, on weaponized attacks, cyber angrips, are those weaponized?
That's a very interesting question that I didn't really work on, but there was a little topic that I already talked about. So,
I already
made my mind out about it. I don't think that that cyber attacks are armed attacks, but they do have real consequences. With cyber attacks, if they blow up an a nuclear power plant, that would be a real attack. But otherwise, those things aren't considered real attacks, but I don't really want to make my mind about that.
Mic 1, please. Hi, thank you for your presentation. You said, if I remember correctly, the only legitimate way for a state to use violence is in self-defense. Maybe I misremember, but how about, for example, within one state, a state would kill a certain group of citizens, so a genocide, and other states want to intervene. What's the international law saying about that?
We have a very prominent example for this one. That is the humanitarian intervention is the example. Kosovo is a very famous example. The NATO decided to intervene, and the Security Council did agree to intervene, but they did correct themselves and go back with the UN.
Und ich bin auch der Auffassung, dass es dieses Modell der
I personally don't think that a humanitarian intervention is possible. In a debate on the council in Germany, they said it isn't really good and we don't want that to happen, but we can't really just watch. So I think that it is not legitimate, but the idea of it to help prevent that genocide, so that would be the job of the UN peace group. The UN did say, yo, please do that, but since they didn't have a mandate for that, a lot of people still see that as wrong. They don't see that as a valid attack.
Meines Erachtens gibt es dafür keine völkerrechtliche
Grundlage. I don't think it is valid, but there is this humanitarian intervention concept that they can have.
Okay, thanks. There's one more question from the internet.
Die Frage kommt Hi. Von Change Root.
So the question is from Change Root. It was posted in English. I hope that I'm translating it well. How are foreign intelligence services handled? For example, activities of the American intelligence services against ISIS groups.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, in general, we have to talk about, if we talk about the right of self-defense, those secret, those secret services,
schreitet. Also wir können ein besseres Beispiel, was für uns besser nachvollziehbar ist, zum Beispiel dieser Tiergartenmord, wo der Georgier
That Tiergarten murder was realistically done by a Russian agent. That is wrong.
Nicht richtig,
and that is not valid, but it isn't really an attack on the integrity of German. In Syria and the USA, they can talk about the jobs of the state, but if they had their fingers in that, if Syria has the right of self-defense, then they should be able to do that, but it is very hypothetical. I didn't really make my mind up about that.
So, we've come to the end of our time slot, but there are still questions in the room. Where will you be for the next hours? Where could people maybe contact you? Well, I'll just be up here at the front, maybe at the back of the room. And you can also use my socials to contact me, and we can meet for a coffee. Give a big round of applause to Dustin Hoffman, please. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening to our translation.